Hello, I'm Matt Matem, Deputy Editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. I'm covering for Jane Crowther while she's on holiday, and today I'm joined by our reviews editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
This week, we'll be talking to the directors of Sundance scaring horror breakout Talk To Me, and we'll be reviewing that film as well as the latest take on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Apple TV Plus's The Beanie Bubble, and a re-release of Sofia Coppola's debut feature, The Virgin Suicides. But before we get onto that, what have you been watching this week?
I saw a new release that's coming out on Wednesday, 2nd of August. It's called Psychopass, Providence. And this is an anime. It's a spin-off from a TV show that's been running a while. So a little bit hard to kind of dive into for the uninitiated. And I will say, I watched it on a streaming link and I had to watch it twice because I couldn't really follow it, to be honest. And I may well have read the synopsis on Wikipedia as well to do a catch up.
Did that clear things up for you at all?
Just about, yeah. Just about. But yeah, I will say after all that, doing my homework properly, I did really like it. Because, yeah, it's very demanding. It's very sort of plot driven. And the basic premise is it's kind of a bit sort of Minority Report, Blade Runner-ish, set in a kind of like a tech noir future where technology kind of determines how likely people are to commit crimes and then unlocks these police weapons so that they can apprehend criminals. So it's all sort of preemptive crime stopping. So yeah, very sort of that controversial. Yeah, and the film's sort of very much in that vein with there's an awful lot of like ethical debate. There's even a bit with someone makes a wedding speech and they like carry on the ethical debate. And there's another bit where someone's actually dangling off a ledge about to die. And they still carry on talking about like the big questions and weighing up, you know, whether you can do the right thing, you know, is justice possible, this kind of thing. So yeah, it's quite demanding and heavy. But yeah, very sort of stylishly done, lots of bursts of action and lots of kind of technoir steam and rain and neon and cool looking trench coats and that sort of thing. So yeah, I'd recommend that for anyone who obviously has watched the series and for people who like kind of harder edged anime.
If anyone hasn't seen the series, do you recommend a bit of research before diving in?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, read up on a few wikis first or try and catch... The series is, I think, I mean, I saw one episode on Crunchyroll, the anime service. I'm not sure where else it's available, but yeah, that certainly seems to be the main place.
This is out in cinemas, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
I must say, beyond the films we're going to be discussing this week, I haven't really been watching that much myself, to be honest. Since the new episodes of Bluey dropped on Disney Plus a couple of weeks ago, I've been sort of portioning those out, partly because obviously everyone in my family likes it. So we have to sort of wait to watch a new one when everyone's available to sit down and watch it together, which is sort of rarer than you might think. But those have obviously been great. I've really enjoyed the few I've watched of those. But yeah, other than that, I've just really been repeat watching Oppenheimer.
How many times have you seen it now?
Well, I've seen it 3 times now.
That's impressive.
Yeah, probably we'll go for a fourth as well. Then I probably should be watching some other stuff as well, because once I do a fourth, that's like 12 hours in the cinema watching Oppenheimer.
That is a
lot.
So probably. What's the Nolan film you've seen the most?
Okay, you make a guess.
I guess Dark Knight.
It's between Dark Knight and Batman Begins.
Okay.
I couldn't call it, but yeah, probably the Dark Knight, because I've seen that on like when it's had like IMAX re-releases and things like that. So but it still probably isn't an absolutely insane number. Sort of Tenet and Dunkirk, Dark Knight Rises, Dark Knight. I think I saw those all 3 times at the cinema. So that's my standard cinema number for Nolan.
That is really impressive. That's dedication.
Yeah, probably haven't seen the Dark Knight more than 10 times. I don't think. I'm probably still under 10.
Is that all?
But yeah, probably like 6 or 7, maybe. Yeah,
that's still a good number because he makes long films, doesn't he?
Yes. Yeah, that's the other thing
for a quickie.
No. So yeah, you got to factor that in as well. But be interesting to see what the final tally ends up being on Oppenheimer, but here we go. I'll keep you updated over the summer. It's partly because I just love seeing them in IMAX when they are available in IMAX, because it's limited windows to get that sort of true experience. That just squeeze them in where I can, really.
Yeah, I was very glad I saw it in IMAX for certain scenes. Although I did think there's a fair chunk of it that would work okay on your TV, to be honest.
What, all the talking and stuff?
Yeah, all the sort of courtroom stuff. I think, I'd quite happily watch that again, you know, and not feel a loss of impact on my TV. But obviously, there are the other sequences which do demand the full scale, the full shebang.
So, right, if we now dive into this week's new releases that we're covering, first, it's time for an unholy communion with this.
You busy tonight?
You want to turn, eh?
My mum leaves at 9.
So you're at 10. Yes!
Where'd you get it from anyway?
Apparently it was the hand of someone who could connect with the dead.
I heard it was the hand of a Satanist. The other hand's just out there.
This is Talk to Me, which is directed by Danny and Michael Philippou. This is an Australian horror film that garnered a lot of attention when it played at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year. And it follows a group of teens who come into possession of a haunted hand that lets them commune with the dead. So, of course, they get drunk and start mucking around with it at parties. And it's not long before there are chilling consequences. And obviously, I mentioned Jane's off this week, but before she went on her holidays, she sat down with the Philippou brothers to record this chat with them about the film.
All right, let's do this! You know the drill. Say, talk to me.
Talk to me.
I love the fact that you guys have been doing this for ages. Even though you're young, you've been doing this since you were kids, really. So I just wanted to find out from you, what was your inspiration when you started as kids? What films were you watching that you wanted to sort of make films like that?
A really big inspiration point for me at very, very young were the Goosebump books. So obsessed with the covers and so obsessed with the stories and so blown away that one person had made them all. That was like my first thing where I was like, oh, I want to be a writer. Like I want to be like R.L. Stine and like create like universes and horror stories. So like that was like an early one. And then like our dad would always let us watch the movies that our mum wouldn't. Our mum was so strict on what we were and weren't allowed to watch that like she was like, you can't watch anything over PG, whereas our dad would just let us watch whatever. So, like, I remember we were really inspired by the Chucky series as kids as well. We did, like, we had a film series called The Evil Flamingo. We did 7 movies based on this, our sister's doll that we would just, like, do, like, all these, like, these makeup effects from, like, 9 to 12 years old. So that was, like, some of our earliest
stuff. Yeah, I'm trying to think, like, the real, real early stuff. The first film that really scared me was we got taken to see Texas Chainsaw Massacre in cinema, and I was... I don't know how old, like 12, 13 years
11,
old.
You were 11.
11.
2013, yeah.
20, yeah, 11. And I had to run out of the cinema. I got so scared. And I remember the lady that took us, I was like, I think I feel sick. I've got to go. And she's like, oh, you're fine. And then like, it just kept getting worse. I'm like, I'm leaving. And I just walked out. I got scarred.
But it scarred you in a great way. I mean, the thing that's as hideous is straight off the bat, we open with this horrific scene that is a real shocker. And it's also, you know, it's about the reaction of others to this incident. Why were you so interested in starting like that and straight out the gate with something truly shocking?
I knew that I wanted to start with a sequence that pulled the audience into the world that we were going to explore. That character Cole was like him leading us through this party and into the world and showing what could happen with characters that come across this hand. So I just see that we wanted to start with something that just like pulled audiences into our like party horror world.
And it was the last thing that we shot. It's the first thing in the film, but it was the very last shot that we shot. Like, because we were shooting. It was COVID was coming down, but it was like we had a lot of people in that party. It's like if we because originally it was going to be the first thing that we shot, but thank God we didn't because. Yeah, I don't know. I think we've all gotten COVID or something. I don't know.
Yeah. But I think that was the main motivation behind that is that, yeah, I just really wanted to pull people.
Because originally it just started with Mia, but yeah, we kind of wanted to start with it. Yeah, like a bit of a bang, you know, and have every corner revealing something new that a cool opening tracking shot we're really excited by as well.
Yeah, it's great. And really sort of, you know, an amazing calling card to start the film. So tell me about the inspiration for this film. I know that you were inspired by a video of a neighbour that you saw. What was it about that so captured your imagination?
We watched them grow up from so young and like to see him in like a vulnerable position like that and having no one help him and people laughing at him and filming it. I just like was unnerving. It was like it just was uncomfortable to watch. So I just remember like all the horror and all the scenes in Talk to Me are all tapping into things that scared me personally. So it was just like there's just so many different elements and things that were like whatever freaked me out at the time, whatever scared me, I was like just expressing that on the page.
You should speak about the hand thing, the accident. Do you hear about that one?
No, that's please like a, tell us.
Well, the, yeah, but this is like one inspiration thing with hands. Like I remember like when I was 16, I was in like a really, really horrific car accident. And I thought I might have broken my spine. I like had cut my eye open here and I was bleeding like you wouldn't believe. And that sort of like inspired like the way that Riley's face puffs up. Like my face morphed into something that you like, I wasn't even recognizable. But I was in hospital after the accident and I couldn't stop shaking. Like the doctors were like giving me heated blankets. They were trying to warm me up and like putting the heaters on in the room. And I just could not stop shaking. I could not get warm. And then my sister came in, she sat next to me and she held my hand. And then automatically all the shaking just stopped. I realized like I wasn't shaking because I was cold. I was shaking because I was in shock. And it was like the touch of someone that I loved and cared about brought me out of it. Found that really interesting is like the effect of human touch and connections between people, how it can like literally stop pain. Like I just found like human connection all the way through the film, like hands are such a motif. And that was like how we ended up coming to the hand in the second draft of the film. Like it just represented everything that we're talking about thematically, whether or not we're conscious of it or not.
Yeah. Tell me about those themes, because obviously it's not just about scaring people and getting them absolutely terrified. There's a lot of different themes going on here. Tell me about how you sort of wanted to explore those.
Yeah, it's like about connections, true connections and forced ones. And, you know, you see that physical touch and that kind of, you know, human connection is a big thing to Mia. And to have that slowly stripped away from her throughout the film, so she has nothing. I relate to that character so much. It's a tragic outcome for her, but it's something that is really powerful to us. And she's rejecting the genuine connections at home, and she's sticking to this forced connection with this hand, which is literally
and reaching even out. With the family. Like I think that she's like a bit forceful, and the hand is representing that, like really desperate. It's sort of how Mia's feeling, and like also the hand to represent vices as well. Like whether it's drugs, alcohol, or sex, it's like even the phrases that like they say. It's just representing those things where it's like, talk to me, like lonely, like Mia's so lonely and wants someone to talk to her. She wants to express how she's feeling to anyone that'll listen. And then I let you in, like I'm letting you into my body, whether or not you're good or bad for me, like whether it's drugs or alcohol or sex, like you're letting this thing into your lives. I think the hand represents so many different things. They're two things that I attached to personally while I was writing it. We touch on mental illness a fair bit. We touch on addiction. We touch on, I don't know. Yeah. It was just all the things that scared us, me personally.
Tell me about shooting this film. So going from, obviously, you've got this very successful YouTube channel, and now you're on a film set, being like properly responsible for a huge amount of people. What was that like, that change? Did it feel like a real step change for you guys?
You know, we've done a lot of crewing on films before the YouTube stuff, so we understood how it worked. And it's something that we always wanted to be. And like, so, you know, having that experience before going into it, I think was very vital, because we would have been way in over our heads if we didn't, you know. So it's two things. It's more pressure because there's a lot more money involved. There's a lot more pressure. But then also it was relieving as well, because you have all these amazing heads of departments, all these creatives that you're collaborating with that focus on these things that we would just do ourselves. And, you know, growing up and making films, we had to do everything ourselves because we couldn't rely on anyone else. Having like an amazing production designer, amazing cinematographer, amazing sound designer, amazing actors that's their whole lives. It's like having that collaboration.
Well, yeah, that's the beautiful thing about film is like all these artists putting all their energies and collaborating into one big project. It's like it's the most incredible experience in the world. It's like, it's more rewarding than a YouTube video for sure.
Yeah, yeah. Tell me as well about doing the in-camera effects. There's some great effects in this, really creepy things. Why was it important that you wanted to do it like for real and not just rely on CG?
All those films still hold up. Everything that did those things practically back in the 80s and back in the 60s, like that stuff still holds up to today. Whereas like, you see that over the years, some CG just falls apart. And so like with our YouTube stuff as well, we did so much practical effects. Like we did so much makeup effects. Yeah, special effects, makeup, prosthetics, I'm obsessed with it. So our Bible, even for that, like our makeup Bible is very big and specific.
Yeah, and like it's always the most fun and looks the best. Like even if you look at real old stuff, like Akira Kurosawa shooting arrows practically, you know, it just looks amazing. And, you know, you watch those movies, like, how did they do that, you know? And they did it practically and found out the ways to do it, you know, safely. It's like, it just brings this authenticity that you're not going to get with like VFX driven stuff.
And there was even like some big effect shots that we had in the film. There was like Mia's hair for the first possession was meant to be floating like she's underwater. And our VFX team did this amazing effect shot of her hair, like looking like it was floating underwater for the possession sequence. But it was just like one step out of the reality and it pulled me out in like in a way that I'm like, I'm so sorry. It looks so good, but I can't use it because it, like it's affecting too much. And like, I'm afraid of it aging and I'm afraid of like pulling people out of the reality of the situation. So like, yeah, trying to ground everything in a reality is important.
It obviously was a huge success at Sundance, massive response to it, and it got bought, and even Stephen King's, you know, talked about it. What's it like to have your work sort of have that many eyes on it and have that reaction to it?
It was the most terrifying experience going to the premiere or in Sundance, the Egyptian theater, because yeah. Everyone was saying A24 is going to be there, critics are going to be there, all these distributors, all these big directors are going to this screening, and we're like, are there any normal people going, like an audience member, you know, anyone, like people that aren't like in the industry that can just like enjoy it for as a film. So, you know, sitting there watching it with those people was the most daunting experience ever. And we were sitting there just hating it. Every time someone would go up to go to the toilet, my heart would sink. Screening ended and we were troughing so bad that I got up. Ari Aster was there. He's the director. And I got up to apologize to him for being dragged here. I was like, God, I'm so sorry you got dragged to this. But as we like walked up to him, he came up and he was like, that was so special. And I was like, really? And we started getting the feedback and then we were like, oh, it connected with the audience. Whereas like we didn't know, though we heard the reactions, like the room was so loud and like, you could hear the reactions. We still are questioning everything. And like, it was stressful.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, you know, it's the first time we were exposed to, you know, like critics feedback on films. Because, you know, YouTube is one thing, but then we respect film so much and like, you know, and for better or for worse, we rely like heavily on Rotten Tomatoes and like, you know, like I always look at Rotten Tomatoes and things. So it's like, are people going to be watching it and like judging it intensely like that? It was a very scary experience, but you know, it paid off. So, thank God.
Paid off. Absolutely. So speaking of going forward, obviously you've got these agents, there must be offers coming in. What's next? Are you going to stay in horror? Are you looking to do something completely different? Where are you going to go next?
Well, I know we definitely want to do an action film down the road, but I still have really want to take another swing at horror. Like I've got a script that we finished called Bring Her Back, me and my co-writer Bill Hinsman, and I love it to death. So I'm like, oh, I'd love to shoot a novel horror film this year or early next year. Would be amazing. So like, we definitely want to explore different genres, but right now I'd love to do another horror film.
Yeah, we've got like, you know, we've got lots of different genre stuff, but yeah, it's like horror, maybe another one makes sense to do next. And then outside of that, yeah, who knows which direction to go with. But with the YouTube stuff, a lot of our smaller ideas we're able to accomplish through the YouTube videos. But we have 30 years of film ideas that have been like just sitting in the vault. And like, once you think of things, ideas, and they stick in your head, you can't get them out until they're made. So it's like, we're gonna get going, people, let's start shooting, you know, let's make movies.
Yeah, let's not waste time chatting about this. Do you think there's potential for this to be a franchise itself? Like, is there a place for it to go for a second film and further?
I would love for it to be franchised. I'd love to do a sequel for this. I'd love to see even someone else's interpretation of the material and stuff. Like, we have a really in-depth mythology Bible that like details every spirit they connected with, every person that's had the hand, the history of it. So we've had this, like, we have that written out as well. And so like, I'd love to be able to do a second Talk to Me. It'd be so fun.
But I think our thing with this was like to have it work as a standalone film, but the idea of continuing it is very exciting. And, you know, we love the world, we love the characters, and we love the idea of going outside of the characters as well to other parts, you know, because you could do it anywhere, really. Like, we're excited. If we have opportunity to do another one, we definitely would.
Okay, so that was the Philippou brothers on Talk to Me. Matthew, I told you a bit about the film beforehand, but I know you haven't seen this yet, so I'll just say a little bit more. But yes, we're in sort of Ouija kind of territory here, you know, is that that's the kind of vibe in a way. Yeah. This film is set in Australia, and it's basically about a group of teenagers who come into possession of this like haunted hand, basically, and they do this ritual where they get strapped to a chair, they hold on to the hand and they say, talk to me. And it basically hooks them up with the kind of spirit of a dead person. Of course, being sort of, you know, teens, rather than just being terrified, they're just kind of mucking around with this. They, you know, keep doing it more and more at parties, people are getting more into it. And then, of course, as you can imagine, terrible things start happening. Yeah, our lead character is Mia, played by Sophie Wilde, and Alexandra Jensen is also a key character, her friend Jade, and Joe Bird as Riley, who also suffers sort of badly from it. And Miranda Otto is also in it as well, as she's a concerned mum.
Does she have much to do?
She's not in it loads, but she has a couple of quite impactful scenes, actually. And yeah, so basically we're basically following Mia, and she also, in the as is the case for a lot of this kind of recent horror films, she's suffering with a kind of grief of her own as well. So she's kind of dealing with personal issues, and that kind of drives her interest in this, you know, ability to connect with the dead as well. What I actually liked a lot about this film is it feels sort of raw and kind of realistic in a way, in the way that you sort of believe that these people would actually act in this way, and they're kind of, they're filming it, you know, and they're getting kind of, you know, social clout from these weird sort of filming experiences, because when the person kind of, you know, becomes possessed or connected, their kind of head throws back, their eyes turn black, and they sort of enter this like sort of trance like state. So it's quite a sort of simple setup, but there are a lot of effective scares in it, and it's kind of like becomes a bit of a mystery as well, like as it goes on, there's kind of a bit of a mystery element to solve. And so that I found quite interesting as well, that it's not just basically a succession of, you know, jump scares. You are actually trying to, you know, learn a bit more about what's going on, and you're finding out a bit more about this this hand. But then equally, it doesn't go too far in that sense and kind of explain everything away. I didn't think as well, despite what I said earlier, I didn't think it went too heavy handed on the grief metaphor. I mean, pardon the pun. Yeah. But I didn't think it went too heavy handed on that metaphor, which obviously sometimes they do. Yeah. And you're just like, this is just purely just a grief story. You've just sort of tacked on a bit of horror to tell your grief story. So yeah, I thought it was really enjoyable. It didn't 100% stick the landing for me. Felt like maybe it ran out of steam a tiny bit right at the end. But that said, I sort of really enjoyed it. Really enjoyable sort of cinema experience. I really liked Sophie Wilde as well, actually, who I saw in another film earlier this year, The Portable Door, which was quite a terrible film. But but she kind of stood out in that, you know, as like when you kind of see someone, you like, they've definitely got that kind of screen presence, and you feel like even though the film's not the best, they feel like one to watch. Yeah, so there was much to enjoy about this.
Yeah, I thought the trailer looked pretty impressive. Kind of reminded me slightly of like the earlier Scream movies, although I assume there's not so much kind of meta-ness or comic relief in this one.
No, not quite so much, but I know what you mean. It has that kind of edge in it, and it's sort of in the way that Scream did at the time, it sort of just kind of feels cool as well, if you know what I mean. It just has that kind of feeling to it, like that these, like the Philippus feel like sort of fresh young voices that I'd be very excited to see next, and that they kind of started off as like YouTube sensations, I believe. So I guess they're kind of coming at filmmaking from a different perspective. And I believe at least one of them worked on The Babadook as well. So they have that kind of bit of history with Australian grief horror. But
that's the kind of benchmark, really, isn't it?
Yeah. And I still wouldn't quite say it. Yeah, I wouldn't quite say it tops that. It's nicely done, and it feels sort of like, it feels like there's a lot of practical effects in it as well, which again, I always appreciate, you know, like feels quite gnarly in that sense. There's a couple of real sort of wince inducing moments, you know, that you get these kind of things that you need a relatively strong, it's not like not the most gory thing I've ever seen, but if you can't handle any sort of gore, it might be a bit much for you in places. But it's very lean as well. Like, it's just, like I say, it's this quite simple story. Just get to know these, you know, like me as the character right at the center, and we get, you know, these few friends and family close to her. And then it's just a sort of a lean sort of 95 minutes as well. So
that's good.
There's no time wasted.
No.
It's like a fun film to see with a crowd. And it has this really sort of freaky kind of cold open as well, which I always enjoy those when they're done well, where you get this kind of sort of scene that feels a bit unrelated to the rest of the film, but kind of gives you a tease of, you know, what to expect, but with just different characters. Yeah. So yeah, it kind of grabs you right from the off, from those opening few minutes, and kind of grabs you and shocks you. And then sort of doesn't let go for the rest of those 90 minutes.
Sounds terrific. I'll be making an effort to see that.
So yes, that is Talk to Me, which is out in cinemas this Friday, the 28th of July. So also out this week is another product origin story, which has become something of a trend this year with Air and the upcoming BlackBerry movie and Flaming Hot. And this is the latest one.
Did you see the latest numbers?
We broke the entire internet thing.
would tell you he did it all? Which is as crazy as believing stuffed animals are gold.
Did you see the truck crash?
Insane.
Poor beanies.
This has always been my company.
Company we created together.
Why do you have to be so dramatic? I mean,
my salary's been reduced 75%.
Yeah, I'm just doing what's necessary. You know, running the real actual business over here.
So this is the Beanie Bubble, which tells the story of the Thai Beanie Babies craze in the 90s and the key players behind it. Matthew, do you want to give a quick introduction to the Beanie Bubble?
Yes. Well, yeah, like you say, it's set in the 80s and 90s. It kind of goes back and forth of these two timelines. And it's about the main figure is Ty Warner, who's the kind of the figurehead of the Beanie Babies empire. But it's also about the three principal women in his life. So there's his business partner, played by Elizabeth Banks. She plays the character Robbie. Then there's Sarah Snook, who plays his kind of love interest, Sheila. And then you've got Geraldine Viswanathan as Maya, who becomes she's a younger sort of intern at the company, who kind of rises up through the ranks, has kind of fantastic business sense, and emerges as a kind of like his Thai's kind of key advisor. So we follow these. We start off in the 80s, then we flip forward to the 90s, then back to the 80s, and so on and so forth through the film, kind of following Ty's relationships and how this empire kind of built up. And then, as you would imagine from the title, how the bubble started to deflate as things went along.
Did you remember that craze from the time?
Not really, no. I'd certainly heard of them. And I've seen the Thai logo on like a few of my son's toys, and I never realised, you know, what that referred to. But yeah, I wasn't really that familiar with it, with what a thing it was. I mean, I don't know if it was over here in the UK, whether it was more of an American thing. But do you remember
it? I have vague memories of like an aunt talking about them being sort of potentially valuable, you know, like with my sort of cousin's toys, but not in any serious detail. And I knew absolutely nothing about the real proper story behind it. And then I wondered as well, watching this film, how much of it was true, because it starts with this quite annoying sort of line at the beginning, as they often do these days, where it says there are parts of the truth you can't make up, the rest we did. So I wasn't quite sure just how much was true and how much all of the women were entirely based on real people, or how much they were amalgamations and that kind of thing.
But I think the Maya character is especially an amalgamation of other real people.
But did you like this film?
Yeah, mostly. Yeah, I thought the main kind of hiccup, I mean, it's quite an ambitious thing to do, but the way the timeline flips back and forth, and you can sort of see the purpose of that, because it's to keep the three women kind of circulating through the film, to kind of keep all the plates spinning and not to ignore them. But it does get a bit kind of random and confusing. There was one bit towards the end where it kind of cuts between the 80s and the 90s, which felt really kind of unnecessary, and I did find quite confusing, and it took me out of the story. I think I would have preferred a more sort of linear build up, really, because it is constantly doing it, like revolving the numbers around from game 86, 92 back to 86. That felt a bit unnecessary. But I thought all four performances were really strong. I mean, yeah, Zach Galifianakis as Ty, and then his three female co-stars, I thought they were all great. You know, there's no sort of weak link here. So I really enjoyed it from that point of view. And I thought it was as successful as any of the other corporate origin stories really this year. But it compared certainly well to Air. I thought it was much kind of sleeker and slicker than Flaming Hot. But just that, yeah, towards the end, I thought the bubble did burst a bit for me somewhat.
But yes. It's boring. It's boring to say, like, oh, I just agree. But I do pretty much agree with what you said, because I thought the timeline thing, there's a few moments where they line things up in ways that are vaguely fun. But beyond that, it's just felt a bit unnecessary. And especially with this kind of rise and fall type story, it does lose some of that momentum, some of that arc that you get from the sort of, you know, the great exciting build up and then the inevitable sort of crumble. Then similarly, like you, I liked all the performances, particularly the women, because I just think Elizabeth Banks, Sarah Snook, and Geraldine Viswanathan, they're all just immensely likable anyway. And I thought they were just very, very enjoyable in this. And so that kind of carried it. And like you say, I thought it was kind of slick, nicely put together. And in the way these films are, there is just something kind of fun about, even when it's very on the nose, but when they're revisiting things like of a certain era, and the way they kind of drop things in, and you're like, oh yeah, I didn't realize that happened like that, or reminding you of the way things happened. And what I kind of either didn't realize or just completely forgotten, but is it was very tied in with the rise of eBay, and how that kind of created this sort of, you know, that drove the sort of collector's market.
That's these, really interesting.
Yeah, these limited edition Beanie Babies. And there's just something quite nice about just revisiting that time, and how it was just, I didn't realize that. And that's kind of interesting. And it's interesting that the element that passed me by the story is just how big Beanie Babies and Tie became. It was just such a huge sort of toy retailer. So there's interesting stuff there. But yeah, like, I wonder if it could have been better served in a more just straightforward linear version of the story. And again,
maybe a mini series.
They
could kind of give all both timelines, give them a bit more room to breathe.
And again, I always feel a bit like if you're making one of these true stories, I don't like it when, I prefer it when there's a sense it's more based on truth rather than just amalgamated characters, because it's just harder to care as much if you don't sort of think that these people necessarily, if they didn't actually do what the film suggests they did.
Yeah, it's kind of an odd mix, isn't it? Sort of close to the truth, but not quite. And then, I sort of feel like, well, maybe a documentary would have served this better. I think it's worth it for the performances.
Yeah.
I really like the way Zach Galifianakis, he gets it absolutely, that balance right of being quite douchey, but also quite charismatic. You can see why people are drawn to him, because he's kind of funny and spontaneous and inventive, but at the same time, he's very sort of petulant. He becomes a real sort of man-child. So, thought he got that balance absolutely right.
Yeah, and I like the sort of thread about his cosmetic surgery as well, that sort of runs through the film. There's some sort of, I thought that was quite well done.
Yeah.
But another thing which I just thought was strange in a random kind of way is the film is co-directed by a husband and wife team of Kristen Gore and Damien Kulash, and he's in the band OK Go, and she is, as her name, you know, may hint, she's the daughter of Al Gore. So I thought it was odd that there's a couple of references to Bill Clinton dropped in throughout to kind of time, to kind of make you realize where you are in time and perhaps draw parallels there with what was going on with him. But it just felt like, because I knew it was directed by her, it just felt a bit odd to me and took me out of the moment. But, you know, there you go. A little fact there for you. But
yeah, it feels quite pointed, doesn't it, when you look at it like that.
And also interesting, what I learned from sort of a piece we had in the magazine was that they were allowed to use the logo, but they couldn't use any of the actual plush toys. So they had to kind of create their own versions of the plush toys. But
it's absolutely swarming with beanies, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, yeah. It's one of those things I thought it was just very, very watchable, but just never sort of truly electrifying, really, for me.
No.
That is The Beanie Bubble, which is streaming on Apple TV Plus and showing in select cinemas from Friday. Okay, so if you're feeling nostalgic for the 80s and 90s after that discussion, then this is the perfect segue into the next film that we're reviewing this week.
Hey, guys, if we weren't monsters that were shunned by society and we could do what we wanted, what would you guys do?
Go to high school.
Maybe get a girlfriend.
Can you imagine that?
Not likely.
This is insane. Turtles, mutant, karate teens. I want to know everything about you.
Our dad is definitely not a giant rat.
That makes me feel like he's a rat.
Police are baffled by the recent crime wave led by a Superfly.
Nobody's ever seen his face.
Why?
Because he kills everyone who does.
Whoa. Cool.
No, not cool.
A bit cool. Can I
kick? So this is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem, which is the latest iteration of the Turtles, who have been reimagined in various forms since they burst onto the scene in the 80s and the 90s. Now, Matthew, you haven't seen this film yet, have you?
Not yet, no. Tell me it's good.
So I will set this one up for you then. So it is a new version of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, who were also known as Teenage Mutant Hero Turtles in the UK in those early days of the animated series. But yes, this is a completely new sort of reboot of the Turtles, and it's kind of functions as an origin story as well, that when we meet these four brothers, they're living in the sewer and they're yearning for like a life outside. They, you know, Splinter their sort of rat father slash mentor sort of is looking after them down in the sewer and doesn't want them to kind of go out and be, you know, spotted by humans who he fears will just turn on them. So they're kind of getting a bit bored and wanting to get out. We also get some flashbacks to how they were, you know, how they became the turtles they are. And then at the same time, you know, there's some other mutations happening that are sort of causing problems around New York with, you know, these different mutated monsters on the loose. That's where we start this story. Obviously, if you probably are likely to be familiar with the turtles in some form. There's something just sort of unmistakable about these humanoid green turtles with a big shell, color coordinated masks, a love of pizza, and they've got their own sort of unique weapons as well. And in this version, which is produced and co-written by Seth Rogen, who the marketing kind of calls like a permanent teenager, it very much focuses on them being teenage and basically plays up that young aspect to it. And that was one thing which I really liked about this film, that I thought there was a really nice energy between the four characters who were sort of all voiced by young actors who I'm actually not familiar with. I don't know if they've kind of done much before, but they certainly weren't people I was familiar with. But they just have a believably sort of young energy to them, and the way they talk and the way they sort of talk over each other and the way they interact. So that was quite nice, because it doesn't feel that they've really particularly been portrayed as teenage much in any of the previous versions, despite the title.
They've always seemed... Well, aren't they selling this as this is the first time teenagers have played the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, aren't they? Because it has always been adults before doing the voices.
Yeah. So, that brings a different and very welcome energy to this. Yeah. And it's directed by Jeff Rowe, who also did the very popular The Mitchells versus the Machines, which was sort of a great animated film from a couple of years ago. It's still on Netflix if you want to check that out. But that was just very, very funny and very inventive. This film, in the sort of Spider-Verse vein, which again has become another sort of big trend of this year, with animations that is kind of pushing the sort of boundaries when it comes to the style a bit more. This has a real sort of sketchy quality to it. It's obviously like kind of 3D CGI animation, but it has a real sort of sketchbook quality. There's little like scribble lines on everything. There's gives it like a really nice sort of texture and kind of handmade feel. And again, adds to this kind of like gnarly energy of the film.
Does it look very similar to Spider-Verse? I mean,
you could definitely feel that there's like an influence, and it's hard to imagine that didn't inspire them in some way. But it does actually have quite a different feel to it, I think, because of that kind of sketchiness. It doesn't have that comic book feel, and it doesn't have the sort of it's more ragged than Spider-Verse in a sort of intentional way. It doesn't feel as sort of beautiful as Spider-Verse films do. But again, it definitely felt like a welcome change. I just loved looking at it, if you know what I mean. It just had that just really, really great look to it. Yeah. And then basically it's got a very, it seems to be set in the present day in the sense that there seems to be smartphones and things like that, but it's got a very 90s soundtrack playing into that nostalgic feeling. A lot of quite obvious 90s needle drops, but there's sort of ones that are just obvious, but they just work really as well, you know, so I couldn't really begrudge them that too much. And there's a kind of great action sequence set to Blackstreet's No Diggity as well, which I really enjoyed. If you've ever been on a Total Film karaoke night, you'll know that we've busted that one out on more than one occasion. So I very much enjoyed that. And
I'll be singing along.
Yeah. And I keep saying energy, but that was one of the things I liked. There was just this really, really great energy to it. And I'm someone who I totally grew up amid the Turtles craze. Like, obviously, I don't remember the Beanie Bubble craze that well, as I said, but Turtles 100% was my bag when I was a sort of a kid in the 80s and 90s, and just have ridiculously fond memories of the first wave of toys. And there's just something about, like, it just sends my sort of nostalgia senses tingling when I see anything Turtles related. And to me, this was so much better than any of the recent films, including the sort of Michael Bay produced live action ones from a few years back. Yeah, and then there was that kind of darker take that was like TMNT. Whereas this one, what I found is it doesn't feel like it's aimed for the youngest of children for a few reasons. Right. I suppose just the fact that I mean, violence never feels as intense, obviously, in a animation as it does in live action. But I guess at the end of the day, they're still using these weapons, and there's quite a lot of fighting in it.
Yeah.
And a small amount of bad language. Like, it's been rated PG by the BBFC, so not for the very youngest children, but still broadly pretty family friendly. If I had any sort of qualms about it, so I came into it as someone who was like, I was going to be an easy sell for this anyway because of my background with Turtles, and I absolutely loved the look of the trailers, and again, just seeing that animation style, the kind of the humor, the younger take on the characters. There's absolutely loads of recognizable voices as well, many of them feeling like they come from the kind of broad Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg, who's his kind of writing and producing partner, kind of coming from that world, such as Paul Rudd's in it. Seth Rogen does a voice, obviously, as well. Maya Rudolph's in it. Ice Cube plays the main baddie, Superfly. And Rose Byrne's in it as well. Obviously, that's another Seth Rogen connection. They've worked together loads.
Oh, yeah, of course.
And there's loads of recognizable voices in it. John Cena, Giancarlo Esposito. So there's just loads of recognizable voices. And there's loads of these different mutants, basically. But they don't really get much screen time because it's obviously we're kind of getting like a Turtles origin story. And then there's kind of sort of two different factions of baddies that we're dealing with as well. So there's a lot going on in that sense that they don't make quite as much of an impact as you might hope. And you don't really get to know the character at all. And like Seth Rogen voices Bebop, who will be familiar. And John Cena voices Rocksteady, but then they're not really in it much at all. Perhaps the voice role that made the most impact for me was Jackie Chan, who voices Splinter. I really enjoyed him in it, and I really like the relationship he has with the guys, and that feels like the strongest part of the film to me. And even to be honest, even the Turtles could have done with a bit more sort of shading out of their characters, I think, because Leonardo is kind of the main character and Michelangelo sort of also get to know him quite well, but Raphael and Donatello, I just didn't feel like we got to know them quite as well as maybe you might hope. But again, I don't really like saying this about films, but this is one where I came away thinking I'm very, very keen for sequels. Like, I hope it kind of does well and we get sort of to spend more time with these guys, get to know them a bit better, and just kind of get to spend more time exploring that world, really, because there's a lot to get through initially in this film.
Does it set but sequels up?
Yeah, I mean, there's the obligatory mid-credit sequence to hang around for. Like, if it's tells a satisfying sort of story, but it definitely feels like there's plenty more sort of road for this. Yes, which I obviously hope they get to explore, because I did really enjoy it despite those few qualms.
Seth Rogen and Evan Goldberg are everywhere this year. Yeah. I noticed I saw Joyride last week, and I noticed they produced that as well, which I hadn't realised. And obviously they've got Super Mario, Invincible, all over the shop, aren't they?
Yeah, the Point Grey Productions must be very busy. So broadly speaking, really, really enjoyed it with just those couple of sort of qualms, but still just very enjoyable. And again, another small qualm of mine, which maybe this is a harsh judgment to make, but because I loved the trailers and I loved the look of the trailers, they got me so excited for the film. I then didn't feel the film sort of massively offered any surprises beyond what I'd really enjoyed in the trailer, if you know what I mean.
Right. Yeah.
Whereas I suppose you always kind of hope, just guess you hope so more, but it just lived up to my high expectations that the trailers set, I suppose, rather than then smashing through them. But
yeah,
a very, very enjoyable, good time. And I'll go and see this again with my son as well. And I'm very much looking forward to that.
Oh, yeah, I am too. Yeah. Yeah, I was never kind of hugely into the Turtles craze. I mean, I remember the arcade machine really well, and the cartoon series and the comics, but the idea of it is such a great, concept. It's such a, it's so fun and likable. It's good to hear that it's decent. Like you say, some of those earlier ones, they feel like they just really haven't, they didn't nail like the Michael Bay ones. They just felt too kind of trying too hard to be cool and violent. And the TMNT was just so grim and lacking that humor, which feels like it's an essential part of the Turtles.
Yeah. This one is very, very funny as well. I really sort of laughed a lot and enjoyed it. And I also meant to mention as well that in this version, they are known by those sort of artist names that, and that's how they're sort of credited, actually, I noticed in the credits, but they're pretty much only referred to as like Donnie, Mikey, Leo, and Raph. So I suppose that's kind of set to sort of try and set them apart a bit and make them seem a bit younger, I suppose. But that's how I probably should have referred to them. But for my nostalgic brain, I'll always kind of think of the full names first off. But still very enjoyable. And so that's Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem, which is out in cinemas next week on Monday, the 31st of July. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, heroes in a half shell, turtle power. Sticking with sort of the 90s and nostalgia, next up we've got this re-release.
Look, she's laughing. He made her laugh.
My intentions for your daughter are entirely honorable.
What might those intentions be?
So much has been said about the girls over the years.
Those girls have a bright future ahead of them.
But we have never found an answer.
Her act was a cry for help.
I heard it was an accident.
Even then, as teenagers, we tried to put the pieces together. We still can't.
We got a full tank of gas. We'll take you anywhere you want to go.
About time. We've been waiting for you guys.
So that was Sofia Coppola's The Virgin Suicides from 1999, which is getting a cinema re-release. So Matthew, for anyone who's not yet familiar with this film, could you set it up for us, please?
Yeah, so this is Sofia Coppola's writing, directing debut. And it also kind of marks like the first sort of adult movie role for Kirsten Dunst. She'd obviously been in things like Little Women and Interview with the Vampire. But here she's kind of... she's essentially the lead, really, of this. Well, it is an ensemble piece. She's one of the five Lisbon sisters who are living, they're teenagers living with their parents in the 1970s. But they're living in this very kind of repressive household. Their parents are James Wood and Kathleen Turner. They're sort of holding them back from doing the partying that they'd really like to do and sort of building up relationships with boys. And as the title suggests, they kind of take some extreme measures, or certainly the film opens with a suicide attempt. So you're kind of on edge throughout the movie, waiting for more sort of drastic things to happen. And it kind of walks this knife edge all the way along between being a kind of very sort of like a serious adult drama, but also it's also a teenage kind of coming of age movie. It sort of reminded me of like Linklater's, some of his movies, especially Dazed and Confused. But all the time you've got this kind of tension threaded throughout the movie. And it's based on a book as well. It's based on Jeffrey Eugenides, then that was his debut as well, actually, written in 1993. So it's a period piece. It's a teenage movie, it feels like a kind of quintessential indie flick as well. It sort of thought of it like that, and it kind of came at that time where American cinema was sort of starting to blossom again, with things like American Beauty and being John Malkovich and Blair Witch Project, sort of harking back to the kind of new wave of the 70s. And this felt like it was really kind of right at the middle of that.
I mean, because it's obviously harking back to the 70s as well, isn't it, in its setting?
Yeah.
And it's one of those weird films where I've revisited it a few times over the years, like at the time and then, like, you know, maybe 10 years later, and then obviously this time later as well. And it's a film that I always slightly struggle to get my head around in a way, but it has this weird sort of like woozy sort of quality. And it obviously feels like, even like now it's hard to think this film is that old, but obviously it was kind of nostalgic, and looking back at the time it was made when it was new. And it's obviously changed a lot for me, because I was like 15 when it came out. So again, you experience it in different ways as you know, come back to it as you get older at each stage, and you see it all differently. But I still slightly struggle to get my head around it in a way, even though I get really sort of swept up in the atmosphere of it. And after watching it again recently for this, it sort of left me really wanting to watch it again, actually, as well. Like, made me think, I just want to kind of take another go at it, because it always feels like I don't know, like there's something mysterious about it that's just slightly out of reach that I can never quite fully get a handle on. But there's just something very enigmatic about it. Another thing about it as well is it's one of those films that will always be entangled with nostalgia for me, because of the sort of the time it came out. And at the time, I just absolutely loved the soundtrack by Air, the French sort of techno music duo, and it's just so good, that soundtrack. I listen to it so much, like much more than I ever watched the film, you know. So just something about that just really takes me back. And it's also interesting because Josh Hartnett has just had a bit of a sort of comeback and has like a decent role in Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
And this was one of his kind of key early roles as well, wasn't it? Where he's this sort of lusted after guy at school.
Trip Fontaine.
Yeah. And everyone fancies him, and he's got this crazy sort of bowl cut type haircut.
That's a wig, apparently, that he's wearing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Quite a convincing wig, but...
It's pretty good, isn't it?
This was like, which surprised me in my most recent view, which I've never noticed before. Maybe you did, Matthew, as a massive Star Wars fan.
Yeah. Gonna say.
But Hayden Christensen's in it.
Yeah,
as well.
Hayden Christensen's in it.
I was like, I just didn't realise that until this recent time, and I was like, oh, wow, that's...
I'd spotted him in one shot, and that was all. Did you notice him much?
I think I spotted him at least two shots. There's one time you see him in the back of a car, and one time you see him dancing at the school dance. But yeah, he's obviously not in it much, but he's there. You could definitely see him. And obviously, funny to think this came out the same year as Phantom Menace. And So, you know, if you're a big Hayden Christensen stan, it's worth checking out just to sort of be completist there.
I hadn't actually seen it since it first came out.
Hadn't you?
It's my first viewing. And I did like it at the time. I mean, it's not my favourite of her movies. There's a fair few others, actually, I prefer. I mean, I love her, like, her city movies, like Lost in Translation and Somewhere, and most recent On the Rocks. But I really enjoyed revisiting it. And I was kind of surprised how funny it was. I don't remember it being quite as funny as that.
Yeah.
Because obviously it's got this very edgy theme. You know, and this very sort of loaded title as well. But yeah, there's a lot of sort of dry humour in it that plays out really well, and all the performances are kind of on point. Although I felt that the sisters, apart from Kirsten Dunst, the other sisters don't get too much of a look in, really. They sort of feel like a bit amorphous, like they don't differentiate them quite as much, which I found slightly odd.
You know, none of them really kind of broke out, did they, after that? Like, as far as I could tell, that none of them really... went on to do much else.
Yeah, well, this AJ Cook was in one of the Final Destinations, and she's like a regular on Criminal Minds. But yeah, in terms of movie roles, I mean, it is, obviously Kirsten Dunst just went stratospheric after that with Spider-Man, and then obviously like Marie Antoinette and all her other big roles.
But yes, an interesting film to revisit anyway. And if you are so inclined to revisit that, that's back in select cinemas again from this Friday as well, 28th of July. That's pretty much it for this week. It's just time for the obligatory request that if you are a fan of this podcast, please subscribe and rate it on your podcast app of choice. You'll never miss an episode, and it helps more people to find us. So everyone's a winner, really. And also, just a reminder that the new issue of Total Film featuring Gareth Edwards, the creator, is still out now on shelves. We've also got Blue Beetle, Harris Dickinson, Past Lives, Ben Wheatley on the Meg 2, loads of stuff in there. So please check that out as well. And then next week we'll be back on the podcast to talk about Joyride, Kokomo City, and hopefully Meg 2 The Trench. But before we go, it's time for the question of the week, which is based on Talk to Me, which dead star would you most like to talk to?
There's so many, gosh. But I think above all, it'd have to be Carrie Fisher. I've met several Star Wars people, as you have over the years, but I got to be in a room with her several times at Star Wars Celebration. But yeah, never actually got to meet her. And yeah, that would be fantastic. And I'd be happy not to talk about Star Wars with her, quite honestly, because she was so witty and clever and worldly. I think you could talk to her about anything and you'd have a great time, not just Star Wars. So yeah, she'd be my absolute number one.
That's a great choice. The first thing that sprung to my mind with this question was, I was thinking of someone who I kind of just missed out on potentially getting the chance to speak to them because they died sort of not long before I started this job and started getting, you know, the chance to actually meet people and speak to them. And it would be Leslie Nielsen, just because I just grew up such a massive fan of the Naked Gun films. And he was just one of those people who just could be just so funny with just a kind of look, or just, you know, anything he said in interviews or on talk shows. I just found him so hysterically funny. So he's one that I always feel like, damn, I wish I'd kind of, you know, got into the game just that little bit earlier to have potentially had that chance. But sadly, never will. But if it was the chance to speak to him via the Talk to Me hand, though, I would not be taking that opportunity. just would accept that I'd missed out. But yes, that's it. Now we're just literally time to say goodbye and then see you again next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Both pilots.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.
I can't get her out of my mind. Wow. I think about the girl all the time. Wow, wow. East side to the west side, pushing fat rides, it's no surprise. She got tricks in the stash, stacking up the cash, fast when it comes to the gas. By no means average, it's on when she's got to have it. Baby, you're a perfect 10, I wanna get in, can I get down so I can? I like the way you work it,
no diggity.
I got to bag it up,
bag it up.
I like the way you work it,
no diggity, no diggity.
I got to bag it up,
bag it up, girl.
I like the way you work it,
no diggity.
I got to bag it up,
bag it up.
I like the way you work it,
no diggity, no
diggity. I got to bag it up.
She's got class and style, shoot knowledge by the pound.